my little Ulaba who loved and hated me. Perhaps she loved and hated you also. I do not know, and I do not ask. She took another sip and set down her cup. You were there when she died. No, do not tell me of it. Some things are better not known. Enough that she is at peace. That was all she said to me, and I saw her only once more, on the following day outside her splendid silk pavilion, when Gobaizi sent word that he was honoured by the offer of Magdala, but on the whole, he'd rather not. So, the amber was hers, says Napier, but she must understand that he was bound to destroy its defences and burn all its buildings to mark the disapproval, that was the word he used, so help me, of its late ruler's conduct in daring to imprison and maltreat British citizens. She assured him that fire could only purify the place, and departed with her retinue, borne in a palki and smiling graciously on the troops who cheered her away. That same afternoon Magdala was set on fire. The king's own had it cleared of its last inhabitants by 4 o'clock. The sappers and miners had laid their charges, and presently, in a series of thunderous explosions, the gates and defences were blown up, the last of the cannon destroyed, and the whole ramshackle town, with its thatched palaces and prisons and houses, put to the torch. It went up in a series of fiery jets, which the wind levelled in a great rushing of flame, which, as Stanley says, turned the whole top of the amber with its 3,000 buildings into a huge lake of fire. The whole army watched, and I heard a fellow say that hell must look like that. But he was wrong. The summer palace burning, that was hell. Wonderful beauty smashed and consumed in a mighty holocaust. Magdala was a vermin-ridden place. The summer palace burning, that was hell. Wonderful beauty smashed and consumed in a mighty holocaust. Magdala was a vermin-ridden pest hole which its dwellers had been only too glad to leave. Indeed, they couldn't get far enough away from it, and it was a swarming multitude, tens of thousands strong, men, women, chicos, beasts, and all their paraphernalia, that set off from Arugi that same day, down the defile to the Bekello. That was Napier's other great concern, to see them safe beyond the reach of the Gala marauders, who'd been denied the plunder of Magdala, and were itching to make up for it at the expense of the fugitives. Our troops rode herd on them the whole way, but Napier would run no risks and had cavalry patrols escort them for another 20 miles beyond the river. The next day, the 18th, the army set off north, with the Sherwood foresters leading the way, their band thumping out "When Johnny Comes Marching Home Again" and "Brighton Camp," and behind them the native infantry sepoys, swinging along, followed by the jingling troopers, the Sindhis and lancers and dragoon guards, and behind them the guns and the matlows of the naval brigade. And last of all, the 33rd, the Irish hooligans of the Duke of Wellington's, the long khaki column winding down the defile, dirty, bedraggled, tired and happy, catching the drift of the music on the air and joining in. "I seek no more the fine and gay. They serve but to remind me how swift the hours did pass away with the girl I left behind me." Napier sat his horse by the track, with Speedy and Charlie Fraser and Merriweather and myself watching them go by. And how they roared and cheered and waved their helmets at the sight of him, the old bug hunter who'd taken them there against all the odds and now was taking them back again. He smiled and nodded and raised his hat to them, looking ever so old and weary, but content, turning in his saddle to gaze back at those three massive peaks where he'd wrought his military miracle, Salesi and Fala, gilded in the morning sun, and beyond them, Magdala, like a huge smouldering volcano, the plume of black smoke towering up into the cloudless sky. "Going home now, gentlemen," says he. And Merriweather said something about a great feat of arms and how the country would acclaim the army and its leader. Napier said he guessed the Queen and the people would be pleased, and HMG also, no doubt. "But you may be sure it will not be all unalloyed satisfaction. It never is." Speedy wasn't having that. "Why, Sir Robert, who can complain except a few miserable croakers? No doubt the same Jeremiahs who swore the campaign was doomed in the first place. And now they'll carp about the cost, as though such a thing was to be fought on the cheap with a scratch army and fleet. They've had it at bargain rates."
I doubt the Treasury will agree with you, laughs Napier in high spirits. No, I was thinking rather of those wiseacres in the clubs and newspapers.